Good morning. Thought we had a tight schedule. Guy was scheduled to testify on the Hill. We're still going to try to get him out of here by 10:30. So if you'll hold your questions to the end, this entire session's on the record. We'll post the slides, and the slides will be posted on the EIA website as well. Given your testimony, we appreciate your willingness to appear today. We also appreciate the audience's willingness to adjust your schedule, because we had to change this to accommodate the earlier start time on the Hill. So, background. For those of us in the energy industry and the energy field, the past few years have really been extraordinary times. Market movements are challenging and changing our perceptions of what things look like. We actually are on the cusp of new transformation. We're looking at the world with new eyes and new perspectives, in part because we haven't seen things develop this way before, and we're simply in new territory in a lot of these ways. But in addition to these new challenges, the work we do here, it's exciting and it's fun, but every now and then you really get the opportunity to work with someone that you both respect and enjoy doing work with. And our guest this morning is just one of those guys. To the extent that those of you that don't know Guy Caruso, his bio is included in the back. It's very extensive. Over 30 years experience, he's been working on energy issues, first with the CIA, held a variety of positions in the United States Department of Energy, in the Policy and International Affairs Office. In 2002, he was nominated to be the administrator for EIA. He also served at the International Energy Agency. So it's a wide range of experience over a long period of time. But the personal side, he's also a CSIS alum, and we always appreciate the fact that he comes here to do the rollout of the International Energy Outlook. The Energy Forecast. And given the situation that we have, especially with $135 oil and $4 gasoline, we thought it's appropriate to have him come in today and to talk about the future. Now, he'll be one of the first people to tell you that the forecasts that the EIA puts out are not pinpoint forecasts of what the future will look like in 2030. In fact, everyone realizes that the future will undoubtedly be quite different. But getting the emerging trends right and doing the analysis and doing the data, that's how sound policy is made, and we need more of it. We're also pleased this morning to have Dr. Jim Schlesinger in attendance, and I can recall a time in the early days of the Department of Energy when we were looking for independent data before we went up on Capitol Hill. We had a chart that he had to present, I think it was to Congressman Dingell on the Energy Committee, and the data that we used was API data because there was no reliable U.S. government data. And he had sent the charts down to have the big placards that you use when you testify on Capitol Hill. And I think it was Bill Heffelfinger that brought the charts back up just before we were going to the Hill. And in the lower left-hand corner, there was the big EIA, site on the chart. And we decided it probably wouldn't be a good idea for the Secretary of Energy to be going up with industry data. And so it was taped over before we went to the Hill. In the 30 years since EIA has been around, we have actually moved from unreliable government data to, I would argue, the gold standard. So if EIA's data and projections are not the best in the world, they're among the handful that people use and refer to as the reference case against which all contemporary analysis are done. And that's a marked contribution, and it's a testament to Guy and the people like him that do this day in and day out, because getting the data and the analysis right is just a key part. On a personal level, in addition to being alumni at CSIS, Bob Ebel and Guy Caruso worked together in 1960 at the Central Intelligence Agency. Dave Pumphrey and I had the opportunity to work with Guy at the Department of Energy in the 1970s when we were all just children. And in the room earlier, we decided that having Dr. Schlesinger, Guy, Dave, Bob, and I, Glenn, all together again, last time we were together, was a crisis situation, probably not a good omen for today. It's a pleasure for me to introduce Guy. I think you'll enjoy the presentation today. I have no doubt that the calmness that he brings to the Hill when he testifies and his straightforward answers, even in the face of $4 gasoline and some tough questioning, you'll appreciate his candor. I always appreciate his calmness. It's a terrific opportunity to be here today. Guy Caruso.
Thank you very much, Frank. It's always a pleasure to be back at CSIS. Very memorable, enjoyable 4 years here, and in particular working with Dr. Schlesinger and Bob Ebel on the Geopolitics of Energy Project. So I'm very pleased that they're here today. And I also want to, before I start presenting the International Energy Outlook, thank Glenn Sweetnam, whose office put this project together. We do it every year in terms of the International Energy Outlook, and the project coordinator, Linda Doman, is here too, and I want to thank you both for your hard work as well as that of all of the women and men of the Energy Information Administration. As Frank has pointed out, the last 30 years has been a real period of intense growth for EIA, and certainly the last 5 years have been extremely busy, and we continue to try to take a systematic approach to the analysis and data, both internationally and domestically. So I really a pleasure to be here and wish you all a good morning. And what we're releasing today is the International Energy Outlook 2008, and all the tables that back up the charts I'll be showing you will be on our website, as well as the highlights. And many of you know, there are a couple key points to be made before getting into the actual data, and that is the one Frank made, that the main point here is the trends that will be highlighted in this outlook, not so much the pinpoint numbers, because we all know that policies and will change over time. This is based on policies that were in place at the end of last year. We all know that trying to get the assumptions right, whether it be oil prices, which we'll talk about in some detail, or GDP growth, population growth, all critically important to these projections, certainly will change. But nevertheless, think of the reference case being presented today as a business as usual case as we look out to 2030. And I'll talk a bit about the high price case as well. So without further background, let me get into the highlights of the latest outlook. And once again, we see strong global growth in energy consumption over the next 25 years. This particular outlook has a 50% increase in the global demand for energy. But probably as important, the vast majority of that growth will be in the emerging markets of those countries that do not belong to the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, the industrialized countries. So this is very much a outlook that focuses on the emerging economies and their impact on the world energy markets. We expect prices will stay high, and we'll get into some detail about that, although we do think that the response to these high prices on the supply side will begin to emerge over the next several years, and by the middle of the next decade, we do have prices coming down, as we'll discuss. The high prices do make a difference, both on demand, but also on alternative supplies such as renewables, and in the case of the electric power sector, coal. Both renewables and coal are the fastest growing fuels in this outlook. And we also expect the share of liquids, particularly petroleum, will decline in the coming years. But because this outlook is so heavily dominated by oil, gas, and coal, we do see continued steady growth in carbon dioxide emissions over this projection period to 2030. This slide shows the global growth in demand, the 50% increase in total that I mentioned, but also the 85% increase in those non-OECD countries, which means that by 2030, the emerging economies in non-OECD countries will consume more than 40% more energy than the OECD countries, which has enormous policy and geopolitical implications. The OECD countries will have relatively slow growth in this time frame. And what's driving that shift away from the industrial countries to the emerging economies is, of course, the robust economic growth that we have already witnessed beginning the early part of this decade with some of the fastest GDP growth in these emerging economies that the IMF has ever recorded, particularly China with more than double-digit growth, but also a number of other emerging economies like India and other countries in Asia, but increasingly important, the countries of the Middle East themselves growing very rapidly. And in this projection, we expect those kinds of growth rates, of course, to decline in percentage terms over this time frame, but nevertheless to remain relatively high, such as about 6.5% for China and almost 6% for India. You also have fairly strong population growth driving some of the regions, particularly Africa and the Middle East, and that will also add to the demand for energy over the next 25 years. I mentioned oil prices as being a key assumption in this outlook. A word about the projections. These oil prices were set late last year as we prepared to do both the annual energy outlook, which is our domestic projections, as well as the international outlook, so that you can see at the front end of this curve projections, the prices are way under where we are today. Nevertheless, I think the main point here is that we do think that over the next 5 to 10 years, the high prices will bring on new supplies that should put downward pressure on price. But we're not going back to the historical low prices we have seen in the 80s and 90s and averaging about $20 per barrel in real terms. We have the price in nominal terms going down to about $70 in 2015 and then rising again, which is about $20 per barrel higher than we were saying a year ago. And so this is the reference case assumption for oil prices. We'll also talk about a high price case later on. In the full report, there's a low price case as well, in addition to two alternative growth cases, a high growth and lower growth in GDP assumptions. Now, what does this do for the fuel distribution? As I mentioned, liquid fuels dominated by petroleum will see its market share decline under these high prices. Shown here, that share goes from about 37% in 2005 to 33% in 2030. So the high prices do reduce consumption, particularly in the countries of the OECD. So we have very slow growth, which we'll highlight in a minute. The other thing it does is bring add to the market share of coal, as coal in some cases in the developing countries displaces oil. But the main driver behind the coal growth is it's the fuel of choice for electric power generation in the emerging economies, particularly in China and India. Now, I mentioned right at the start that we're talking here about a no policy change world, and that means that this case, this reference case, business as usual, does not contain any carbon constraints, whether it be a carbon tax or some global agreement. So that's a very important caveat when one looks at this kind of growth in coal on a global basis, and in particular in the emerging economies. Natural gas more or less holds its own at 24% of the world's energy, although it's hard to tell from because the base is so low. Renewables do grow significantly in this outlook, but still only about 8% of the world's total energy. Nuclear power, as we'll talk about in a minute, grows as well and everywhere except in the Europe, in the EU, where some countries have policy decisions to actually phase out nuclear. When one looks at the liquids consumption by region, again, what jumps out at us is the very strong growth in non-OECD countries or emerging economies, led by the Asian non-OECD countries of China, India, Southeast Asia, where they have more than a doubling of liquids consumption in this outlook. Other emerging economies also grow between 40 to 60%, particularly the Middle East, where there is rapid GDP growth as well as rapid population growth. Whereas when you look at North America, Europe, particularly the EU, and Japan and Korea, members of the OECD, there is very small growth. And even in the U.S., or North America, where the growth is several million barrels a day, about half of that is in biofuels. So the petroleum, the component of this liquids growth in North America, is very moderate. And the reason we see the growth in the emerging economies is largely the transportation sector. About three-quarters of all the liquids growth in this outlook is in the transportation sector, with very strong vehicle population of vehicles in China, India, and Brazil growing sharply, whereas in most of the developed countries, the growth is relatively small. And again, a footnote to the U.S., although we have substantial growth in our light-duty vehicle fleet, the composition of that fleet in our domestic outlook shifts significantly. About 45% of new car sales in this outlook in the U.S. are alternatively fueled vehicles, hybrids, turbo diesels, and flex fuels vehicles. So even though there is significant growth in the light-duty vehicle fleet in the U.S., the composition changes, and we're already seeing that happen with vehicle sales composition in the first several months of 08 shifting to smaller vehicles and away from the SUVs, the larger SUVs. Where will the supply come from? Well, we have a total liquids demand in this outlook of about 113 million barrels a day in 2030. And again, going back to Frank's point, the pinpoint number is not as important as the trend, and that is we do see, you know, moderate growth. When you look underneath where that growth will come from, both OPEC and non-OPEC supplies are projected to increase, but a significant part of that growth is in unconventional liquids, and we'll talk in more detail, but it's oil sands and biofuels are the biggest part of that. And we'll look at some of the individual countries that comprised that growth in the non-OPEC countries. And this, as just a reminder, includes biofuels and other non-petroleum liquids. So just keep that in mind as you look at the U.S. growth from a little over 8 million barrels a day in 2005 to almost 10. A large share of that growth is biofuels as mandated by the U.S. Congress in the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007. We also see a significant increase in other liquids as well. We have some coal to liquids in the U.S. outlook at these prices, and some increase in domestic lower 48 production because of deep water fines and enhanced oil recovery, both at $100 per barrel. There are a number of projects that become economic in the U.S. Canada's growth is mostly oil sands, liquids from oil sands. We're very optimistic about Russia's potential, and should say that our assumption in all of these supply cases is that the main driver of supply in non-OPEC in particular is the resource base, and we believe the resource base in Russia will allow substantial development. Now, whether policies are above the ground policies and other risks permit this kind of growth, obviously no one really knows, but this is based on how our assessment of what the resources are in Russia, as well as Caspian significant growth in Kazakhstan, particularly with the Kashagan field coming on stream probably 2011 or 2012. And then within Africa, this is mostly non-OPEC West Africa and the Gulf of Guinea. The Central and South American numbers are very heavily dominated by Brazil's growth. Very substantial deep water reserves have been discovered in Brazil, and we have steady growth in conventional crude as well as about 700,000 barrels a day of ethanol in that number for Brazil. Among OPEC, of course, the reserves, again, drive this projection, and the reserve base in the Persian Gulf members of OPEC, particularly Saudi, but also Iraq and Qatar, we do think there is significant potential for growth, and therefore that's where most of the increase in OPEC conventional liquids come from, although we do have also significant increases in Angola and Nigeria in this outlook for OPEC. We mentioned the important role of unconventional liquids. This is our best judgment at this time as to where those unconventional liquids will come from. And I mentioned oil sands in Canada, and this shows almost quadrupling of the oil sands production, up to over 4 million barrels a day. And then the next largest is the biofuels. The U.S. is the about half of that growth in biofuels. And then ultra-heavy oils, that's largely the Orinoco in Venezuela. And then coal to liquids, both in the U.S. and China, increase. We've actually scaled down this projection from what we were looking at a year ago because the cost assessments have continued to go up as the infrastructure cost of building these projects continues to rise, and therefore this year's projection is actually a bit lower than we were saying a year ago, even though liquids prices are higher. And of course, we all recognize how uncertain the oil price outlook is, and therefore we look at three different cases in this outlook. The high price case goes to over $180 per barrel in nominal terms by 2030. One could say what seems to be the case we're on, at least in the near term. And therefore, we decided it was important to really focus on that and what does that mean for the supply of oil, both in OPEC and non-OPEC, and what does it mean for the demand numbers. We assume that even at the higher price case, that there won't be constraints on development of some of these unconventional fuels, and as well as the we assume that OPEC would choose to defend the higher price and therefore would accept a lower production rate. If you were to make a different assumption, you would probably move back down toward the reference case. For example, if you were to assume OPEC doesn't want to see its market share decline, then that's the key difference here. And the reason is that as you look at these higher prices and the lower price case shown here, you do get a significant impact on consumption. Price does matter over the long term. The short-term responsiveness to price, demand to price, has been quite low, and that's perfectly consistent with the economic literature. But as time goes on, the long-term price elasticity or price response of demand does go up, and we do see more than a 10 million barrel a day decline in consumption at the higher price case. And it varies a bit across regions, partly because of the individual countries' policies with respect to subsidies of the local economies. For example, in the Middle East, prices are very low for the end user, and therefore you don't see as much a price response there as you do in the OECD countries, where for the most part prices are allowed to be passed to the end user, as we are discovering in our own country here. And so we have significant declines in consumption at the higher price case in industrial countries, in China and India and other emerging economies. And what does it mean for the individual suppliers of those liquids? You can see here that under that assumption where OPEC allows its market share to decline in order to defend the higher price, their share goes down by far the most, whereas the non-OPEC goes down, but not as much. And the economics of developing some more unconventional liquids becomes very attractive, including coal to liquids in places like China and our own country, and the oil sands in particular, assuming, of course, as I mentioned, that the constraints that currently are troubling the Alberta developers of oil sands that are not restrictive, and that is human capital as well as infrastructure. We do see those things easing off over such a long time frame. If for one reason or another that is not true, then of course we would take some of that demand out of supply out of unconventionals, and it would go to back to OPEC. Let me turn to natural gas, another fuel that will grow steadily and across the regions, but in particular, we do see significant growth in the emerging economies of Asia in particular, but also in the Middle East itself as they produce more gas in Qatar, in Iran, and others, as the petrochemical industries within the Middle East will use a significant amount of that gas, as well as a rapidly growing LNG industry. But we do see steady growth in world natural gas consumption, allowing natural gas to maintain about 24% of world energy. Where will the gas production come from? In Asia, we see growth in Malaysia, Indonesia, and some of the other Southeast Asia countries. But by far, the Middle East, led by Qatar, Iran, will grow very robustly, as well as the Russian gas, which will be largely going to European customers. I mentioned, of course, that coal is a major beneficiary of higher liquid fuel prices and the very rapid growth of electric power demand in China, India, and other emerging economies. This shows that that growth steadily throughout the forecast period, going from 123 quadrillion BTUs to 202. It's 2% a year. But the key is that China alone, in this scenario, accounts for 71% of that growth. The other growth areas are in the U.S. under a non-carbon constrained policy environment. Other important policy or technological assumption here is that we do not assume that carbon capture and storage technology is in place during this outlook. That could also make a big difference in these numbers. The driver behind that coal growth I mentioned was electric power generation, and the growth again concentrated in emerging economies with nearly a tripling of the amount of electric power generated in the non-OECD, whereas OECD grows much more moderately. And this shows that coal really gains the coal and natural gas have the predominant share. 71% of all electric power is generated by coal and gas in this outlook in 2030. It's about 61% now. I mentioned nuclear would grow, and we do see a significant resurgence of nuclear. We have, in this outlook, a net basis, 87 gigawatts of new nuclear power capacity come online during this 25-year period. China alone, we're projecting 45 gigawatts. Other big increases in India and Russia and the United States at a net of plus 15 gigawatts for the U.S. The only place where there is a decline, as I mentioned, is the in the EU, where Germany and Belgium have policies to reduce the amount of phase-out nuclear power in those countries. Unless that policy changes, that's why you see a decline there in OECD Europe. Renewable energy grows steadily at over 2% per year in both emerging economies as well as industrial countries. But there is a difference between that renewable power or of choice, the renewable source of choice in those two regions. Or in the non-OECD emerging economies, most of the renewable growth is hydro, both large and small hydro, whereas in OECD countries, it's wind and biomass, whereas hydro has been pretty much maxed out in those countries. What does this all mean for environmental issues, particularly climate change? It means that a fossil fuel dominated world, particularly in the with the growth of electric power, increasing the demand for coal, as I've shown, you get steady growth in carbon dioxide emissions from about 28 billion metric tons in 2005 to 42.3, to be precise, in 2030. That's a 51% increase, most of which is in of that increase is in the emerging economies, as is consistent with the demand numbers we've discussed. And on a fuel-by-fuel source, of course, coal accounts for the largest share with 44%, and liquids the next largest. So to sum up, this is an outlook driven by very strong growth in emerging economies, which leads to about a 50% increase in world energy consumption, an 85% increase in those emerging economies alone, with, we believe, high oil prices relative to history, does affect liquid fuel consumption and does affect the fuel choice, and we do see growth in renewables and movement away from liquids to other fuels such as coal. But by far the most important component of the growth in consumption is how heavily it moves towards the emerging economies such as China and India. And without policy change, this business's usual case does mean steady growth in the carbon dioxide emissions by about 1.7% per year, which is very similar to the growth in total energy consumption. So with that, I once again want to remind everyone that everything EIA does is on our website, including this presentation today and all of the backup tables. And for those interested in climate change analysis, we recently published an assessment of what the Lieberman-Warner proposal bill being proposed would do for energy supply, demand, and prices in the United States, and that's on there too. So Frank and all of those of you who are kind enough to come out this morning, I really appreciate your being here, and I look forward to responding to questions you may have.
Thanks, Guy. A couple of quick questions. On Warner Lieberman, would the analysis that was done by EIA to reflect the new update in the IEO, would those numbers change the switch from coal to gas appreciably? And then on CCS, was that a technology assumption or a policy assumption that it wouldn't be ready?
On the first question, the Lieberman-Warner proposals, which have very stringent targets on greenhouse gas emissions, would significantly reduce the amount of coal use in the U.S. That's the one thing, and therefore it carries over into this global outlook and does raise prices and lower GDP a bit. On the CCS, carbon capture storage, it's largely a technology assumption.
Okay.
Economics, right now the economics of CCS as well as the technology are indicate that it will be beyond the 2030 time frame.
Okay, great. In terms of questions, two simple rules here. We have microphones for the size of the crowd, so when you raise your hand, wait for your mic. If you could identify yourself, that's a key point. Know who you are. And then if now you've lost my train of thought. Identify yourself, and if you pose your question in the form of a question, that would be extremely helpful, and Dr. Schlesinger gets the first question. So,
is this all based on a recession-free world, as you look at those prices, that is, the economy does grow smoothly?
Yes, that's a very good question, of course, that the average GDP growth assumes a steady growth, but indeed what the real world will show is you'll have sick cycles. But over time, this reflects our macroeconomists' best judgment as to where of the average growth. So it does not specifically forecast recessions and then spikes in growth. But on average, it would assume that we would have some cyclical movement. Yes.
Yeah. The question is the run up in energy prices. Wouldn't that bring down the trend line on the rate of growth?
The over that long a period, the economies tend to, based on the macroeconomic analysis, tend to adjust, although higher, it is fair to say that growth would be higher at lower oil prices.
Leonard Oberlander, consultant. Since aircraft can use only liquid fuels and not any of the alternatives, coal or wind, solar, and so forth, with the availability, has there been any assessment yet of the availability and price of oil for aircraft affecting the aviation industry, particularly in those countries and regions that have the availability and those that have to pay higher prices for the oil?
Yeah, we're assuming that you're right about the, of course, aircraft, although I know the Department of Defense is doing some testing in terms of what military aircraft might be able to do with some of these alternative liquid fuels. But, yeah, the answer is it does affect the transportation sector, but we've that's taken into account in our model.
Go to the back on this side.
Hi, Tom Doggett with Reuters. Guy, in the forecast, compared to last year's forecast, you've raised the oil output for Saudi Arabia in the short term, like 2010 and I think 2015, but you've cut it dramatically by several million barrels way out, 2025, 2030. Mm-hmm. What's the reason behind that? Do you think the Saudis aren't going to be able to increase their production by as much as they're thinking or hoping?
No, Tom, I think it go back to the assumption I mentioned that for that high price case, the assumption was that OPEC would accept a lower market share in order to have a higher price. I mean, that's strictly an assumption. Pardon?
Sorry, this is your reference case.
Yeah. Even in the reference case, the OPEC share, the market share is held constant. And in order to deal with the increasing amount of unconventional liquids, the share of market share stays a constant. That's just an assumption. There's no, I wouldn't read anything into that in individual country analyses. It's not a reflection of our views of what where the Saudis are going beyond 2015 or so.
Let me ask a question. On the slide that I just put back up, because I think it goes to this point a little bit, we've been talking about the same thing. And I think your assumptions are similar to what we've been using, that if in a higher price environment, the projects that have been delayed come on third, fourth quarter 2008, beginning of 2009, including alternative fuels, mm-hmm. you get some demand destruction, so you actually see near-term price relief, right, in the short term,
yes.
and then it picks back up. Is that your assumption as well?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. John.
Jonathan Elkind, Eastlink Consulting and Brookings Institution. Guy, Frank's setup included the suggestion that we are entering into a period where the game has changed or is changing. And I know that that's not the business of this presentation, but rather is to project where you would end up given current trends. However, could you speak, please, a little bit about some of the, you know, the potential sensitivity cases that the elements of the picture where you could end up with a very different future and how that future would differ, whether it's CCS or non-availability of some of the resource base that you talked about, Russia, mm-hmm. elsewhere, et cetera.
No, I think that's quite right, John. There's some game-changing technologies that for just because we have no way of projecting when they will come on, and that could make a big difference. CCS is clearly one of them. In terms of coal, it could make the picture actually better for coal. On the other hand, a strict carbon tax or some other form of carbon restraints would than mean movement, that growth in coal that was shown there would then have to probably, using the Lieberman-Warner analysis, would move to either nuclear, if that was possible, to really ramp up much more, or more renewables, or indeed natural gas. So that's on the product mix. If you get the other one is plug-in hybrids on the transportation sector. I think that since transportation accounts for 75% of the growth in liquids in that outlook I just presented, clearly anything that happens in the transportation sector, whether it be technology or policy driven, can make a big difference in that liquid fuels number over that long a time frame, because you can actually turn an automobile fleet over in 15 years. So capital stock effect of would make a difference. But on the above the ground risk, to put it in a bigger, of course, Russia would be part of that on the oil and particularly oil, but also gas side. I think that to the extent that any constraints are placed on those non-OPEC supplies, it just then means OPEC either has an easier time defending the higher price case in this outlook, or to the extent that, let's say, Russia doesn't live up to that growth, that supply would then shift to, in most case, most likely to OPEC, because that's where the resources are. And we have really, back to Tom's question, we have constrained OPEC below what we think they're capable of doing on a resource base alone, largely because we see them as, we've made the assumption that they would accept either constant market share or even a declining market share in order to sustain higher prices.
Yeah. There's a bigger piece here, too. The carbon constraint, we've argued, is the game changer. In an 85% fossil fuel-dependent world, if you change that structure, huge switches take place. So in an unabashed pitch for some of the work we're doing here, we're updating the geopolitics study that was done in 2001. We talk about the transition, the transformation,
but it's
longer term.
On that point, Frank, I think another thing that the insight you get out of a model like this or our domestic model, again, not so much the pinpoint numbers, but how big a job it is on a scale basis. When you take it to the global, it's even more impressive to talk about changing an 85 million barrel a day liquids world, or the kinds of the shifts in coal away from coal that we're talking about.
Yeah, it's decades.
It's enormous. It's enormous.
We'll go on this side, and then we'll come back to that.
Andy Patterson with Econergy. Would you hazard a high price case for natural gas now as well, particularly since it takes so long to build the alternatives, coal and nuclear, and utility commissions seem to be dashing us to gas again?
Well, our high price case in the U.S. It's a little under $8 in MCF in real terms. So we may be taking another look at that for 2009.
Well, in the Warner Lieberman analysis, though, the gas demand increases like 100%, 140%.
In the case where you have nuclear constrained,
right,
you get even a much higher gas price. That's
what is?
I'll have to get. It's in the website. I don't have it off the top of my head, but it.
Go back and I'll come back.
Hi, I'm Jeff Napshin from Clean Skies TV. Let me ask you this. If I'm reading this correctly, are you projecting that in 2030 the high potential price for a barrel of oil is $186 for a barrel of oil? Is that what you're saying?
No, this is an assumption. We're using that as an assumption to test the model.
Mm-hmm.
What if?
But given what we've seen recently,
we're not saying that it couldn't be higher or lower.
But given what we've seen recently, again, just in the last couple of months, I mean, theoretically now, what could we be looking at? If you're saying 186 based on previous models, are we talking 200-300, or what? How high do you think it could go with by that year?
Well, I mean, our view is that given that price, you bring on, you do two things. You bring on a lot of new supplies of liquid fuels, and you reduce the consumption growth. So when we look at that, we see that, you know, it seems to, it's consistent with both the supply and demand analysis. Now, one could test that at different prices, but our judgment as to as a reasonable, a prudent assumption. There's nothing particularly. We're not predicting that. It's not a model that determines the price. It's strictly an assumption.
In terms of price predictions, for those of you that are fans of Jon Stewart, last week on TV, they ran a price correlation of oil against temperature. And the chart showed that since December to June, that the temperature had increased from 55 degrees to 95 degrees. And the assumption was that by the end of the year, it could be well over 200. So just kind of put it in context right in front here. James, it's okay.
Joe Kamelick with ISIS News. Mr. Crusoe, there's a lot of talk, increasing talk on Capitol Hill about opening the Outer Continental Shelf, those areas of the OCS that are now under congressional or presidential moratoria. What would be the impact of those reserves on both global supply and U.S. supply and pricing if they were to come online over the next 10, 15 years?
Well, we in our annual energy outlook for 2007, we did run a open access to OCS case, and it showed that it would be a relatively small effect because it would take such a long time to bring that new supplies on. So we do have that in our annual energy outlook 2007. I think it was something like only a couple hundred thousand barrels a day in that outlook, and therefore over such a long period of time, that doesn't affect the price that much. Of course, with higher prices now, we might get a little bit different outcome, but the key is that in terms of impact on price, that it does take a long time to develop these resources, and therefore the price impact is muted by that.
Okay. Faribor's, and then we'll go right behind you.
Thank you. Faribor's Gador, CSIS.
Hi, Faribor's.
Hi, guys. How are you? Your model shows a rapid increase in Qatar and Iran gas production. What assumptions with regard to sanctions on Iranian gas production are implied, if any?
Yeah, that's what we've done in all the resource assessments is we assume that after about 2015 that the main driver is just a resource base. So we, for whatever, any above-the-ground constraints, we relax them after 2015. It's just purely an assumption. We have no – it's not a reflection of any judgment or knowledge that things will change.
Richard Ranger, American Petroleum Institute. Guy, what are your assumptions, I missed them, regarding any changes in the mix for fuel supply for electric power generation in North America? You noted in Europe there might be a slight decrease in reliance on nuclear. What are you looking at in terms of the mix between coal, nuclear, and natural gas?
Yeah, we're relying on the analysis done for the annual energy outlook in the U.S., which showed that coal in the U.S. increases its share of generation from about 50% now to 54% in 2030. And the main, the fuel that gives up market share in that scenario is natural gas. And that's directly related to one of the earlier questions, and that is much higher prices of natural gas, an assumption that coal price stays kind of close to where it is now in the as input to electric power, and that, again, once again, no carbon restraints. And we have about a net 15 gigawatts of increase in nuclear power in that outlook. And the fourth part of the mix is that renewables also grow very rapidly as a result of the 25 or 6 states that have renewable portfolio standards in their states.
On the nuclear side, what assumptions do you put in on retirement of the existing fleet? Do you extend them 20 years? Or?
We only retire, I believe it's 2 or 3 gigawatts.
Okay.
Of the older plants. We assume extensions are granted by NRC for the remainder.
Okay. Sydney? James, right up front.
Thank you. Sydney Weintraub, CSIS. Guy, how in Latin America, I noticed you had to make projections for two uncertain places, Brazil on the upside and Mexico on a completely uncertain side. How big an increase do you think Brazil will have by the end of your period?
We have a very, very strong, I can give you the specific number, but it's several million barrels per day increase, including biofuels, between now and 2030. And for Mexico, we have it kind of flattening out, I believe, but I get you the exact number. The one other area in Latin America where it's more difficult is Venezuela. You know, we have them pretty flat in this outlook in conventional crude and have an increase in the Orinoco heavy oil. But, you know, when I was here 6 years ago, we were projecting that Venezuela would be 5 million barrels a day by 2010. And now they're probably going to be half that. So, I mean, it's just, you're absolutely right. I just, as an example of how uncertain that is.
Kyle Gracie with SustainUs. For the projected growth in renewables, what is the breakdown by type in 2030?
By far the largest is a hydro in the emerging economies, and then wind and biomass in EU and in US. And we have the precise numbers in the tables, but in big picture terms, that we see a lot of new hydro in Asia and in other emerging economies.
David Ashworth, Medley Capital. Given the gap between your reference case price for 2008 and EIA's WTI projected price, which is, I think, $120 a barrel, is that basically your assessment of a strategic risk premium or speculative premium on prices at the moment?
I wouldn't, David. You know, I think basically when we set these prices a year, well, 9, 7, 8 months ago, we thought the fundamentals would be weaker in 08, and therefore we actually had lower prices than we see now. And the difference is the fundamentals have gotten tighter. We like many, overestimated what new non-OPEC supply would do for 08. Partly that's the delay in projects coming online, but it's also the steeper decline in Mexico, as Sid alluded to, and weaker growth, almost no growth in Russia, and the decline in the North Sea. So on the supply side, very disappointing non-OPEC supply response, and more growth in the developing countries than we would have thought at these higher prices, partly because many of their consumers are having their prices subsidized, like in China, India, and many other emerging economies. So it's mainly that the fundamentals have tightened, and we're now living in a world where, I don't know, depending on what's going on actually in Nigeria these days, we have very little spare productive capacity, maybe 1 or 1.5 million barrels a day out of an 87 million barrel a day world. So that's the main change.
Bob Kopeikin, hi, Guy.
Hey, Bob.
What assumptions, if any, do you have in the Chinese forecast for adoption of clean coal technology? based on import of new equipment?
Yeah, we're assuming that they take advantage of the latest equipment. However, the most I think the main assumption is that they will meet their demand, very rapidly growing demand for electric power, and that they'll use the least cost source of generation, which of course for them right now is coal. Certainly, to the extent that the technology is available and affordable, they'll take advantage of that as well. That's our basic assumption.
Robert Schroeder with International Investor. A simple question on methodology on this. EIA, when you turn to sources for reserves and production, who specifically are you asking, and how many of them are government sources versus private sources?
That's a good question. We rely a lot on the USGS resource assessments, but we also buy commercial data from the leading suppliers of commercial resource data, and Glenn and his team are currently working on a global resource assessment. We presented some preliminary results of that at our conference in April, and that's on the website, using that latest data. But we'll release that full report in the coming months. So what we're trying to do is get a sense of what the actually oil in place, both conventional and unconventional, is, and match that up against the various demand scenarios to look at. Really, it came about as a result of how do we answer the questions about peak oil.
Can you just give us a guess how many are government sources versus private?
On government sources, we rely on the USGS as our main source there, and then we have two commercial services that we subscribe to. But I don't want to give them an advertisement. I mentioned their names.
We come back in front.
Paul Harmon with R.W. Beck. Your base case scenario for unconventional liquid, you showed oil shale at essentially zero. Were any of the scenarios, did oil shale appear at all?
I think in the high price case, you start to get a little bit, a very small amount. Is that correct, Glenn? But it's too small to show up on the chart. But that's another area, John, game changing. If the technology on in situ production of shale oil were to advance, that's another one that could make a big difference. But again, the scale would take such a long time, but the resources is clearly there at some price and technological breakthrough.
John Easton, Edison Electric Institute. Guy, with the increase in coal generation from 50 to 54% out to 2030, how do you take into account the short-term trend of cancellation of coal plants that we're seeing? Probably a wide variety of reasons for those cancellations, but certainly significant environmental opposition to new coal has led to those cancellations. How do you account for that, and how does the trend continue to grow then from 50 to 54%?
That's good, John. Good question, John. I the model basically says what's the capital cost of building a new generating plant, what's the fuel cost, and what's the levelized cost, and when you need new capacity, it says, oh, build a coal plant. And as a result, using that methodology, you get lots of new coal. Now, if we have not constrained that, because at the time when the AEO was produced late last year, that although some of these factors you mentioned, restraints, were in the wind, they still seemed a bit uncertain. If by the 2009 annual energy outlook, which we're starting to work on right now, we're seeing those kinds of constraints actually being put into law or some other regulatory constraints, we will then factor them in. But to try to just guess at what a governor of a particular state might do, or So we don't constrain it unless the actual state or local area has actually imposed some form of law or regulatory restriction. But we will do that once that's in place.
Colin Derner from ABC News. Could you explain a little bit further how you reached the world oil prices, the high, low, in Methan's case?
I should have chose a different slide.
Yeah, I mean, what we did was take a, you know, our best judgment as to where we thought the prices, what set of prices would test the system and see whether there would be sufficient supply to meet the demand at those prices. It's strictly an assumption. It's not a prediction. And then what, then looking at what the implications are of those different cases. So it's basically a judgment call among our experts is how we arrived at those assessment. And as I pointed out, that it's a couple of other questions that we do look at, would the resources sustain the demand that at the various, so there is a resource element to it as well, and then there's a huge assumption really about what would OPEC behavior be like.
Down front. Okay. We'll go to Sarah, then we'll come back down front. Go ahead.
Sarah Ladislaw from CSIS. In previous outlooks, you've done some really great topical discussions about supply constraints in terms of supply chain, and you mentioned in the oil sands case human capital and resources, and we're seeing increasingly in the news, whether it be oil or coal or natural gas or nuclear, real doubts about how fast you can scale up some of these specific fuel contributions. Do you have something similar in this outlook, conversations about raw materials and some of the supply chain constraints, or does that just feed through in prices?
I think up until 2015, we take into account those constraints that we feel we have a pretty good handle on. Beyond 2015, since that does allow time for capital to both human capital as well as infrastructure requirements to kind of work themselves. The high cost of steel, for example, would tend to level off, and some of the other infrastructure costs, that given enough time, we release those constraints, sort of, so to speak, and then rely mainly on resource assessment and, as I just mentioned, in the case of oil, some judgments about what OPEC policy might be.
Okay, we have a question right down front.
Leopard Kapovic, Russia Business Council. What is the assumption for the future gas, oil, and nuclear production in Russia? The gas and oil has been falling this year, you know that. And do you think Russia is going to constrain its production for the future to drive the prices up? Or how's it going to go? What's your assumption in your model on that? Thank you.
Now, we're very optimistic about the Russian production of both oil and gas. In this outlook, we have about a 4 million barrel a day growth in Russian production, or oil production, by 2030. And again, that's strictly based on what our assessment of the resource base is there. And we would assume no above the ground constraints after 2015. Now that, you know, everyone would have their own views on that, but that's the methodology we're using. We have it constrained up to 2015 based on current what knowledge we have of current investment plans, but then after 2015 we say, what could Russia do given their resource base? And that's how we get to that. And similarly with gas.
Okay, we have another question here, second row.
Hello, my name is Svetlana Francis, Group of 30. Quick question, since you do this outlook every year, were there any differences or unexpected findings compared to previous years, something that came unexpected for you in your research over the years? Thank you.
The question, if you didn't hear it, was there any new surprises in the 08 outlook that was different from previous projections?
Oh, I think one is that some of the constraints on costs meant that we had to revise our unconventional liquids down a bit. That was somewhat of a surprise. Other than that, I think pretty much consistent with what we would have thought. I don't know. Do Glenn or Linda have any?
I just think the non-OECD growth continues to surprise to the upside. The non-OECD growth. And then, of course, the non-OPEC production being a little bit more delayed than we thought.
Okay. Inside.
Thank you. My name is Patrick Dowden with the Stanford Financial Group. There's a substantial discrepancy between the current price of energy and what was anticipated in the production of this study. Do you feel that this discrepancy is best accounted for by a change in fundamentals of supply and demand economics, increasing risk premium in oil-producing countries, or speculation by large-cap investors in the energy markets?
Yes.
Yeah, our view is most of it can be explained by the fundamentals of supply and demand, but I mean, we recognize how complex this market has become with all the rush of financial investments out of equities and into commodities. So that's probably playing some role, but it's very difficult to quantify. I mean, the data is just not really available to make a judgment on that. And then there are other factors, you know. We think the risk premium or geological, geopolitical risks are priced into the fundamentals. For example, when Nigeria, some production goes offline there, that certainly is influencing the futures market and perceptions of future supply. So we think that's actually fundamental to the decisions as companies decide to take oil in or out of inventory. So our judgment is most of it is these fundamental changes in the supply and demand, strong growth in China, Middle East, and disappointing results in non-OPEC supply.
On the JETA conference, Guy was at the JETA conference with Secretary Bodman. The discussion, the reporting coming out of the conference seems to indicate that while there was a lot of discussion on what the causes were for the market, whether it's dollar decline, speculation, fundamentals, that there was very little agreement on both sides, that a lot of the positions that folks came in to the meeting with, that's what they left with. Do you want to comment at all about?
Well, I think that's a fair assessment. You know, the main point was to get together and to ear to views, and probably the most important thing was the recognition that these high prices are having a detrimental effect on the economies of all the countries that were represented there, and even the companies. I mean, it's not when the companies that were there spoke, you know, they all said that the investment, that the impact of higher prices is affects their investment as well, uncertainty right. In terms of investment signals. So that's probably the one consistent thing. But, you know, I think OPEC countries have been saying for some time now that it's not us.
Right.
Don't blame us. So I wasn't surprised by that.
Okay. And since I opened a can of worms on the unabated temperature rise, let me go on record in saying that our projection is that temperatures will fall before the end of the year. And that's on the record. Thank you all for coming today. Please join me in thanking Guy Caruso for an excellent presentation.